This lecture, entitled How to Change Your Luck, is dedicated to the merit and honor of the Goldenberg family.
You know, in the English language, no blessing is more appreciated than the blessing of good luck. Among Jews throughout the world, on every joyous occasion, whether it be a chasana, a wedding, a birth, a bris, a bar mitzvah, they're all inevitably accompanied with the Jewish equivalent, which is mazel tov. Mazel, or luck, seems to play an inordinate role in our lives. And very often we're not just satisfied for the luck to come. We want to change it. Some of us run to tzaddikim, to holy men, for their blessings. Some carry with them amulets, good luck charms. But is this merely an illusion? Does luck or mazel really exist? And if it does exist, is there really any way, really, to change it? Probably the best way to summarize tonight's lecture is with the following apocryphal story. The hero of our story, we'll call him Moshe. And Moshe was a very pious man. He always prayed. He was very observant. He lived a righteous life. But unfortunately, he was dogged with bad luck. Things just didn't go his way. And he had a very hard time making a living. And what bothered him the most, whenever he would read in the newspaper the stories about the winners in the lottery. It then became the super lottery. It wasn't just winning 3 million or 10 million. It was 200 million. Why do those people deserve to get it and not me? After all, I don't know of anybody more deserving than me myself. So he began really to pray in earnest. He was crying and he was praying and he didn't give up. Morning and the afternoon and evening, day after day, week after week, month after month. And his name still didn't appear in the newspapers. And then finally he was giving it all that he got. And he was crying. He's almost down on his knees. And a voice from heaven came. He says, Moshele, meet me halfway. Buy a ticket. The purpose of this lecture is to find out where we can obtain this proverbial ticket. Now, I've divided this lecture into 7 parts. The beginning of each section, which I'm going to tell you, spells out the acronym FORTUNE. Before we start, basically all that I'm going to quote to you from quotes is from the Talmud. It is a rich source of wisdom. And we're going to quote, or at least paraphrase, various sections from the Talmud. Each one shedding a little light on this subject. But before we begin, I'd like to explain the root of the word mazel. What does mazel come from? And it seems that it's related to the Hebrew word nozel, which means to drip down, to flow down. It's as if from on high, just like water, through gravity, flows down from high to low, so to speak, the blessings or the influence goes from above to below. The word mazel is used for luck and fortune in general. It's used specifically when it refers to the constellations. The 12 constellations, the signs of the zodiac, are called in Hebrew mazolos. It refers also to the idea that every person has a guardian angel. And that guardian angel is also called mazel. because it comes, the force comes from above to below. Now there's a whole question if there's a way that I could discover what my mazel is. Some people look at horoscopes, and there's a whole controversy if there really is any substance to astrology. There's another controversy in terms of palm reading. Is there any substance to it? You know, I'm sure yourself have read stories related to palm reading. I'm reminded there was an interesting book that came out over the last 20 years or so. Several books came out of Holocaust memoirs. People who lived through the Holocaust, the difficult times, who kept it in, didn't share it with their family for so many years, but felt that finally there should be some record of the experiences that they lived through. One of those books was called The Scent of Snowflowers. And in it, it related an interesting story about this woman who's the heroine. It's an autobiography. And she brought her sister, together with her, to someone who was a palm reader. And the story is that she looked at this, the one who wrote the book, her hand, and said, "You'll have 3 children. You'll live a long life." And then she looked at her sister's hand and she began to cry, scream. Because "I see," says, "that you'll have 3 children, but you and the children will be burned to death." And he says, it came true. They went to the crematoriums. And she survived and went on to build a family. It's really hard to know. But one thing is really important from the standpoint of Jewish law, the Talmud. And it's a verse which is in this week's Torah reading. It's Tomim Tieh Mashem Alekech. You should be pure in your trust of God. Don't look at your horoscope. Don't find someone who's going to tell you your future. If you trust, that itself will change your fortune. And I'd like first to begin with I'm going to quote or paraphrase 3 sections of the Talmud, each one dealing with another aspect of this fate. And it's all based on the notion that before a person is born, at least the major course of one's life has already been predestined. And I'm going to quote 3 sources for this. One is a source from a Gemara in Shabbos, it's 156a, where the Gemara says, the Gemara and Talmud are synonymous, where the Talmud says, quotes Rabbi Hanina, "The mazel gives wisdom, the mazel gives wealth." Says one's fate, the fate of all of mankind, is determined by the mazel. In a little greater detail, this was from a passage in the Talmud in Shabbos. There's another passage, another tractate called Moed Katan. And there in Moed Katan in 28a, Rava makes a statement, Bonei Chaya Mezonim. So the amount of children a person has, or his longevity, how long a person is going to live, and his wealth, his muzzle, his food, is predetermined. It's not dependent on one's merits. And we're going to say, why isn't that so? We're going to discuss this. But it's really dependent on the mazel. There's a person who's fated at birth to live this life. And Rava historically quotes 2 people with whom he was very familiar. One was Rav Chisda, who was actually one time his father-in-law. And the other was Rabba. Rav Chisda, they were both great tzaddikim, great saints. People whose prayers were, when they prayed in difficult times and times of drought, their prayers were effective. They were leaders amongst the Jewish people. Yet Rav Chisda lived to be 92 years old, and Rav only lives to be 40. Rav Chisda had many children, and there were many simchas, many joyous occasions in his life. Rabba, there were many deaths in his life. Rav Chisda was blessed with great wealth. He describes it, there was so much that there was fine flour that they had to give to the dogs. And there was so much the dogs wouldn't eat it. Whereas Rabba only had barley flour to live on, and there wasn't enough for the people. So somehow we see from these are puzzle pieces that we're going to put together. But we see from these two initial passages, there is something of predestination. For the first one, we see the wealth and wisdom are predetermined. He adds to this list one, the length of life, and one's children, and it's very difficult to change, if at all. And that leads us to the third passage, the third quote. And this is from a Gemara in Nida. This is the last of the tractates of the Talmud, 16b. There the Talmud says that before a person is born, really it's 9 months before, the time of conception, poetically it describes as if the drop, the embryo, is brought before God Himself. And the question is asked, what is the fate of this child? Will the person be strong or weak? You know, each one has a different constitution. Will he be wise or not wise? Will he be rich or will he be poor? One thing, though, is not predetermined. This is really one of the pillars of Judaism. It's not predetermined if you're going to be a righteous person or not. That's left up to the person himself. Some people are born into tremendous wealth, others born in terrible poverty. Some people are super geniuses, and others really have a very difficult time mastering, you know, what would be normal activity. Some people have a strong constitution, other people are weak. But they can all change their lives to be good people. That's really one of the pillars of Judaism. So now, this is the first of my fortune, and I call that fate. So the F of fortune, fate, is that there is something which is fated really at the time of conception itself. Not even birth, but conception. We're going to go into further detail. How do you change it? Can you change it? But that's the first. F is fate. Now just before we go on to the next section and dealing with mazel, to tell you that there is a term which many are familiar with, which is shlemazel. One of those great people of history that at least felt he himself was a shlemazel, one who had bad luck, was one of the great biblical commentators and scholars of the 12th century, Avram ibn Ezra. Avram ibn Ezra said his mazel, his so poor, his luck, that if he would go into the business of selling candles, says the sun would never set. And if he would go into the business of selling shrouds, no one would die. Just to end this section, what is the source of the word shlemazel? And really it's really two words. Of course, the end is mazel. The word shlim is really an old German word which means bad. In English, as the language evolved, the word shlim became slim, like slim pickings, slim chance. Originally meant bad, but it began to look thin. So it's interesting how words change. But therefore, shlemazel is bad mazel. What's shlemiel? Shlemiel is the one who causes bad things. As in the famous story of the waiter who serves his customer soup and he slips. And unfortunately, the hot soup lands on the customer. The waiter is a schlemiel. The customer is a schlemazel. Which takes us now to the O, which is ordained. We spoke about a fate. Again, this is fortune. So F is fate, O is ordained. I'm doing this so you should land, you'll remember this class, hopefully. Say, hey, what was that O again? So we spoke about things which are fated at the time of conception. Other things, though, are fated throughout your life. In the introduction, it was spoken of the idea of we are judged on Rosh Hashanah. The whole idea of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur deals with judgment. There's a judgment, though, spoken of, that goes through every minute of our lives. There's a constant judgment as well. The one on Rosh Hashanah is more fixed, harder to change. But really, we are being constantly reviewed. And again, I'd like to quote again with several passages of the Talmud to give you a flavor, at least a taste, of what I'm referring to. One is a statement from Rabbi Hanina, who says, if you bruise your finger, you just got a new painting, you have to hang up a nail in the wall, and you're banging and banging, and the hammer hits your finger. He says, that was bashert. Not necessarily the time you're born or when you're conceived, but anything that happens to a person, there's a power above. The Talmud in a different tractate, this Avodah Zarah, from 55a, deals with sicknesses. And it says there that when a person is fated to be sick, the time, the onset of the illness has been decreed. The length of the illness is decreed. The doctor to whom will affect the healing is decreed, and the medicine is decreed. In other words, when it happens, it just is, well, I just got sick. Again, there's something that's part of a divine plan. It's no fun being sick. How are we supposed to look at all of this? Like when things are good, you say, ah, things are wonderful. But what happens when things aren't so good? There's a Gemara in Brachos. It's the first of the tractates of the Talmud, 60b, which quotes Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva was always had a motto, that whatever happens is for the best. Whenever any umglik, any even the worst things, he would say, it's all for the best. And he illustrated this with the following story. He was once, evidently he was a young man, he was on the road, he was traveling, and he went to a village, a town, and he wanted some lodging. Evidently they didn't, either the local inn was filled or wasn't available, and he knocked on people's homes. No one wanted to let him in. Absolutely no one. So he was traveling in those days. This was before the advent of cars, jeeps, Hummers. So he went, what was then in antiquity, the jeep of antiquity, which was a donkey. So the donkey carried all of his belongings. He also carried with him a lamp, probably some tinder to light, a lamp. And he brought with him a rooster, which was the ancient equivalent of an alarm clock, so he could start his day. He had no place. They wouldn't let him in the town. So he went to the forest, which was nearby. And in a forest at night could be a dangerous place. But he felt safe. At least he had the lamp. But in the middle of the night, a strong wind came and blew out the lamp. Then a lion came. There used to be, there are no lions in the land around Israel today. But in ancient times, there was the Mesopotamian lion. I mean, lions. The Romans really depleted the population of lions during the time of when they ruled the land and brought them to the gladiatorial fights. So there's no more lions. In Rechabus' time, there were still lions. A lion came and devoured his donkey. And then a cat came, a weasel, and attacked his rooster. So he's all in the dark. He doesn't have a lamp. He has all his stuff. He doesn't have any donkey to carry his stuff. In the middle of the night, while after this occurred, a band of marauders, brigands, went, attacked the town, and took every man, woman, and child captive. And they would take them to the slave market. It's a lucrative market. I mean, it's really a shameful thing, but it is how did most of the African Americans come to this country was very often by these slave traders who would attack people, villages, and take these people and sell them for slaves. So that's what happened there. And Rabbi Akiva, commenting on that, says, you know, it's an amazing thing. Had I been there in the town, had they shown me hospitality, I would be one of the victims. And even after I went to the forest, if anyone would have seen my lamp, they would know there's a person there. They would have kind of come to the forest after me. If they would have heard my donkey braying, or would have heard the rooster says give off its sounds, they would have come after me. So he looks, didn't I tell you everything that God does is for the best? The Talmud illustrates this idea, a slightly different way. Brachos is the first tractate of the Talmud. The last tractate of the Talmud is called Nida. And in it, there's a Gemara, says in Nida in 31a, where it explains a verse in Psalms that says, I'll give thanks to you, or says Hashem, O Lord, for you were angry with me, your anger left me, and then you comforted me. He says, what does it mean, I give thanks to you that you were angry at me? And it explains it with the following story. There were two people, their partners in business. Each one was bringing merchandise, had hired a ship, were bringing merchandise from their country, which was evidently was abundance of merchandise. They could get it at a reasonable price, and they were exporting it, or going by ship, to an area where this merchandise was scarce. And they were hoping to reap a great profit. At the last minute, one of the partners slipped, fell, was injured, needed medical attention, and could not make the trip. Therefore, he missed out on this wonderful opportunity. And his friend, of course, took his merchandise and made the trip. And he was cursing. He was angry. And his mood finally changed when he heard that the ship with all the merchandise and his friend sunk. So in retrospect, he said, thank you, O Lord, says that you were angry with me. Because that anger comforted me. Now, there are many stories, I don't know if you've read them, those who were not in the Twin Towers at 9/11, or those who were not on the planes that hit the towers or the Pentagon or crashed in Pennsylvania. Each one has their story, their mazel. I heard this story, before we go to the next section here, I heard this story from one of the Rosh Yeshivas in the Tells Yeshiva in Cleveland, Isaac Osband, Gesund, who as a young man was a student in the Tells Yeshiva in Lithuania. Most of Lithuanian Jews were exterminated by the Nazis, including virtually all of the Yeshiva of Tells. There was a small group of young men, some 16 in all, who happened to find themselves at the time of the attack of the Russians on June 21st, 1941. They happened to be near a train station. This was the last train leaving Lithuania going to Russia. These 16 young men bought tickets and they came to the first car to let them in. As it was stuffed with people, they were frightened. They had no inkling of what the Nazis would do. I mean, the extent of the Holocaust, but they knew it would be very difficult for them. And after all, Lithuania had already been annexed by Russia, so it wasn't a question of traveling to a different country. It was just going further away from the enemy. If you look, you can imagine the scene. There are many cars on a train. The engine is way ahead. They came to the first car, knocked on the car that the passenger should let them in. No one wanted to let them in. You could feel the desperation. They went to the second car. No one let them in. They kept on going from car to car to find they came to the car which was closest to the engine. And then there was a group of people who saw them. They recognized they're from the yeshiva, Yeshiva Bachram. They let them in. They pushed themselves in. And the train left. While the train was going, this was traveling away, the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, came and bombed the train. Didn't hit the engine, but hit in the middle of the cars. So after the plane left, the train couldn't move anymore. So what the engineer did was he disattached the mangled cars from those cars who were still able to go. And he went. All of those who remained, of course, and who were not killed by the bombing itself, were actually killed by the German army that came and killed all of those who survived. Had this group of 16 young men been offered the hospitality of the first car, the second car, the third car, fourth car, they wouldn't be alive to tell the story. So again, what seems to be an umglück, you know, seems to be a tragedy, this is part of the fate. Not necessarily when before a person is born, but there's a constant supervision. And that's the O of ordained. You know, it's very, we're speaking about the, it's Elul time, it's the month before Rosh Hashanah. There's a custom among Sephardic Jews to say slichos, and those are special prayers that it said from the beginning of the month. For Ashkenazic Jews, the custom is the week before Rosh Hashanah, around the week before Rosh Hashanah. Many of those who worked in the Twin Towers came late to work that day because in the time when you say slichos, davening is just a little bit later. And they came a little late and they missed the planes. So just amongst those stories. But again, we'll touch upon as we go further. So again, F is fate, which is the initial fate. O is ordained. The R is for recklessness. And here I quote a Gemara, another tractate of the Talmud, Shabbos. This is 32a, where it quotes Rabbi Yannai, who says that before he would cross a bridge, he would always check it to make sure it was structurally sound. He didn't want to tempt fate. Because a person is constantly judged, not just on Rosh Hashanah. He's being constantly judged. And if you're in a situation where if nature would take its course, something bad would happen to the person, and you need a divine intervention to save the person, well, that's a judgment in itself. And if a person is saved, his merits are deducted, so to speak. There has to be intervention on his behalf. So, on one hand, we view this, everything is bashert. But on the other hand, you could find yourself in a situation that for God to intervene, there would be a miracle. Because he has to do something. It does happen. But you don't count on it. You have to be prudent in your life. There's a flip side to this as well. Again, we spoke about what this touches upon is really a different angle, a different facet. One is we look at the major course of your life is predetermined, the family you have, the course of life you're going to have. We speak about what happens on every Rosh Hashanah, how a person is judged. We speak even as a person is judged every minute of his life. But if you put yourself in a negative situation, there has to be certain intervention. You can't necessarily count on that. The person is rejudged and saved. But there's a flip side to this, where there's a Gemara in Pesachim in 112a, where Rabbi Akiva advises his son, you know, when you do business, you enter a partnership, do it with somebody who has a good mazel. Someone thinks you're going well for it. Because once you're part of it, it'll shine on you too. Like, since God has to do it for that person, you're part of it, you're going to have. So he says, you know, stick with people who have a good mazel. This now takes us now to the T. So fortune is fate, ordained, recklessness. The T is teshuva. Of the judgments that happen on Rosh Hashanah, or throughout a person's life, one thing that changes it, of course, is repentance. The Talmud, there's a Gemara Rosh Hashanah on 16b, that mentions really four or five things that can change the outcome. One, of course, is repentance. You change your life, you become a different person. One is prayer. The idea of prayer, just by the way, like, how does prayer work? Now, generally, we have a wish list. Give me this and give me that, and I need this and I need that. And, you know, how come I prayed yesterday and I didn't get it yet? Come on, you know, I'm waiting. The essence of prayer is really you put your life in God's hands. That's what really prayer is all about. That you express it, you're in charge of the major things in life and the minor things in life. When we pray, we mention our history, we mention the major things God does, mention the major things we as individuals, as a nation needs. But ultimately what we're saying is we want you to become involved in our life, and we know that you want to become more involved in our life. That's what prayer is. It really creates a relationship. It's not a gimme. It's not just a list of, you know, you're nagging and nagging. I'm reminded of a cute joke. It was told to me by someone who wasn't particularly religious, so you could appreciate this. But you could also appreciate the way that some people pray. So it's, and according to the joke, there are two friends. One is very successful, and one has a very hard time making a living. The one who's successful goes to the synagogue 3 times a year. The one who's having a hard time goes 3 times a day. And from time to time they would come and visit and, you know, to each other, speak about old times. And finally, the one who was having a hard time couldn't control himself and told his friends, who was much more fortunate. He says, "I don't understand. You know, I daven, I pray 3 times a day. You only daven 3 times a year. And look what you have." So the wealthy man turned to him and says, "You know the problem with you? You nudge it too much. You know, you nag too much." Well, but that's the kind of prayer that, you know, it isn't nagging. It's basically, it's a relationship. Those two, if you remember, says in the Nisana Tokef prayer, which is a commonly said in synagogues, it's a very moving prayer, who's going to live and who's going to die. And then afterwards the congregation says, "Ushashuva, tzedaka, mavir, and esroya hagzera." Says that our prayers, our repentance, our charity can remove, change the decree. It's based on this passage in the Talmud. There's a fourth way of changing things, and they describe changing one's name. And if you're familiar, some of these people are extremely sick, and they go to the synagogue and they change the name. But as the Maimonides explains, symbolically it's part of one's major change. I'm a different person. I happen to know someone whose son was extremely sick, had some autoimmune disorder. It wasn't, and he changed his name. He's not called by that other first name. The other possibility that the Talmud entertains is about changing one's location, moving. Also, like it's a new start. Remember, there was a song after the Six-Day War. I think it was Rabin, "Natsa Mechakel Rabin." And one of the stanzas is "Meshaneh Makom, Meshaneh Mazal." Change your place, you change your mazal, your foot. That's this Gemara. It's based on this passage. But it's possible when the Gemara speaks about teshuva, about repentance, they're referring to those changes, those directives that are done on Rosh Hashanah. They are not referring specifically, though, to the fate. We speak about this mazel, you know, that before one is born. How does one change that? And that really comes to the idea. This is the T of fortune. Again, fate, ordained, recklessness, teshuva, the U is uplifting. The person has to make a radical change in one's life for mazel to be changed. This is much harder to change that which is really comes, you know, that's there in a sense genetically. Like, that's you. Much harder to change that. The Talmud, there's a passage in Shabbos in 156b that tells the story of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was told by an astrologer that his daughter would die the day that she would be married. It didn't stop him from doing the preparations and finding a wonderful husband for his daughter, but he still had some slight fear. After the wedding, she had on her wedding hat, whatever she had, there was a brooch, and it was like a pin. So she took it out, like she was getting undressed. She took it out, and she put it into the wall. The walls were a little different than our walls. Even if you look at these walls, you could put a pin in them. But so she stuck it into the wall, and it was late at night, so really she didn't see what was doing. In the morning, she got up to get dressed again. She took out the pin. She realized there was a snake trailing the pin. There had been a snake at the wall evidently was poised to come. And at that moment, she didn't see what she was doing, but she stuck the pin in the eye of the snake, went through the brain of the snake, killed the snake. She told her father, and evidently this was the fated thing, she was going to die that night. And he asked her, did you do anything unusual during the wedding? He says, yes, in fact. There was a poor man who came at the wedding. No one paid attention to him. He wanted a meal. You know, today people, familiar people that are impoverished, have difficulties, will come and ask for help. But rarely do we have someone who knocks on the door for a meal. He was a man asking for a meal, and they were all busy with the festivities. No one paid him any attention. So she gave up her meal that night, the night she was married. She gave up her meal to that poor man. So Rabbi Akiva commented, that saved your life. But it's a major... This is not just giving tzedakah. You know, this is not giving charity. It's not just sharing. We make calculations. Well, I made so much. My after-tax income is so much. So much. This is a different kind of charity. You go hungry. You're the kala. You're the bride. But she couldn't see the indignity that this man is suffering. No one's looking at him, and he's hungry. So she figured, I'll get somebody. I'm not going to starve eventually. Something's going to happen. She gave away her meal. That saved her. So one thing is doing something which is a radical change. There's another means also we quoted before from another passage in the Gemara Nida. This is taken from 70b in Nida, where the famous is one of the great teachers of the Talmud, Rabbi Yeshua. And he visited Alexandria, which at that time was a major, not only a major center of culture in the Hellenist world, but it was a major Jewish community. And he met with the elders of the community. And they asked him several questions. Among the questions that they asked him is, what should a person do to become wealthy? Remember, wealth is one of those things that's predetermined. And he said, well, you should deal honestly in business. He says, many have tried that. It didn't work. He says, well, you should pray to the one who is the source of all wealth. So just tell us to pray. You have to do both. You have to be involved in business with integrity, and you have to give your life over to God by praying. And he asked a similar question, how does one become wise? Also, one of those things we start with, predetermined. And his answer was also, he says, you have to devote more time to study. He says, yeah, but there are people who spend time studying and have not become wise. Well, you have to pray. So just tell us, you have to do both. Because you need both. So we find the idea of prayer, though, sometimes at least, can alter. Because basically you've changed your relationship with God. Normally you look at yourself, I'm independent. You know, as long as God doesn't interfere with my life, things are fine. Prayer is, my life is God's. He just didn't design the DNA in our cells or design this fabulous universe and the whole system of matter and energy and elements and molecules and everything, how it fits in so beautifully. He's interested in us. And he says, I want to have a relationship with you. You know, we've touched upon this idea of mazel before we go further, and that's the uplifting. But it seems so unfair. You know, we could talk about Rosh Hashanah, a person's judge. Well, a person's judge, what kind of a person he is. If you're one kind of a person, you judge one way, another person way, you judge another way. But why is it that before you're born, it's fated that you should have this kind of a life and that kind of a life? You look at this person, he had such an easy life. Look at another person, that person had such a hard life. Like, it just doesn't seem to be fair. And really, this touches upon one of the great principles of the Kabbalah, of the Jewish mystic tradition. According to the mystic tradition, and which is paralleled, we find in the belief in the Eastern religions, there's a notion of reincarnation. This is not necessarily the first time we're here on earth. And when we see our lives, we just see one chapter of our life. There have been many chapters before this life, and who knows how many chapters after this life. We just have we have this myopic vision. We just see what we see now. But the truth is, this is how the Vilna Gaon, the famous Gaon of Vilna, explains the idea of mazel. Is your life has a certain path based on the life that you led before. If a person, for instance, again, this is not what the Vilna Gaon said, but just to give you in Yiddish, a Beispiel, and it's just a for instance. If a person in one lifetime was blessed with tremendous wealth, but was not charitable, he couldn't feel the pain that others feel. In another lifetime, perhaps, he's born with that pain. He's born into poverty, and he knows what suffering is. You know, there's a very cute story, unrelated to reincarnation, but it brings home this idea. One of the great rabbis, one of the great rabbinic scholars, in Europe, a little over 200 years ago, his name was Rabbi Cheska Landau. He was the chief rabbi of Prague. And as a communal leader, it was responsible for him to make sure that the poor were taken care of. And there was a particularly cold night, and he was afraid that the poor would not have enough firewood to last through these cold, wintry nights. And he visited the home of a wealthy man. It was really late at night already. He knocked on the door. He was wearing his fur coat, his pelts, and he was wearing his fur coat. And the man came to the door, but he was really dressed in his night clothing. And he says, "Rebbe, what do I owe this honor? Why are you coming so late?" And he told him about it's really something important that I have to speak to. He says, he opened the door. He's at 16 below, He opened the door, and he says, "Rebbe, kum terein, why don't you come in?" He says, no, it'll just take a second. So the door is open. This person is in his night clothing. And the rabbi tells him about how difficult it is for the poor people of the town. They don't have sufficient firewood, and it's such a cold night. And if there is somehow that you could help, he says, "You know what? I have two stacks, of logs there. So I have plenty in the house right now. Go take it. Give it to the poor." And then he asks the rabbi, he says, "Rabbi, you could have told me this inside the house. You have to tell me with the door open." He says, "Yeah, but if I told you inside the house, you wouldn't feel their pain like you feel now." Sometimes we have to go through things to feel, to understand what other people went through. But it's part of this idea of reincarnation, which is a basic tenet. We ask the question, and we really don't have good answers. At the end of all days, when Mashiach comes, when Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah the prophet comes, maybe we'll have the real answer. But we look at our history. It's a history full of tears, of difficulties. The last major tragedy, of course, was the Holocaust. This is during the period of World War II. And people often ask me, how do you understand this? Not dealing with the answer directly, but understanding the idea of reincarnation, that the people who died didn't die in the sense of extermination. Most of you here may be children, real children of the Holocaust, meaning you were alive then. It doesn't answer the Holocaust, but it frames the question totally differently. Because it's really one part of one's odyssey through life, that a person has to live through various experiences. And we're still around. I just recently read a story, this is interesting, again, an anecdote is no proof of anything. But there was a boy who had these recurring dreams of the railroad tracks. Basically, what came out as a concentration camp. And the boy was not particularly religious, but happened to go together with a group that visited the remnants of the various camps. I'm not sure if it was in Buchenwald or in Birkenau. He was in some place where they had the gas chambers that looked like showers, and he was transfixed. He was like, I've been here before. He was never read Holocaust, but he felt that it was real. So it goes really beyond this class about the major, what happens. But it's important to realize that every single person, at least this is the Jewish belief, is taken care of uniquely. And we are here for a mission, so to speak. What are all these incarnations for? What are we here for? Because the purpose is ultimately to become a better person, a person who's closer to God, who's a loving person, and who serves humanity. That's the end result. We just go through our own lifetime, or perhaps other lifetimes, trying to reach that goal. And we're prodded here, and we're prodded there, and this experience, and that experience. But ultimately, the final product is really God wants each and every one of us to be great. I just want to finish now just the very last two. The N of fortune is negativity. And here I quote, there's a passage in the Talmud in Kesubos, it's one of the tractates in 8b, where it describes a person with a foul mouth. And it says that even if it had been fated originally, he should have a good life, but his whole mazel could change because he's already turned his life the other way. Because this person was born, he originally had a certain fate, a positive fate. But if a person lowers themselves, makes them, instead of being, we're speaking about the purpose of life is really to become more godly, to be more giving, more saintly. And a person turns that around, his whole mazel could change. And finally, the E of fortune is endurance. Sometimes good things are fated. They're going to come. We have to have the patience. The Talmud tells a story, this end of Brachos, the tractate Brachos in 64a, that there were two candidates to head the yeshiva. This was the Masifta, this was the central scholarly academy. One was Rabba and one was Rav Yosef. And it was decided because of the talents of Rav Yosef, he had a phenomenal memory, that he was to be the one to be chosen for that position. But he declined. Because the thing about astrologers, an astrologer once told him, he was a psychic, looked at him, he says, you're going to have the highest position, but you're only going to live for 2 years. So he figured, I could put this off. No rush. It's like the joke about the prisoner on death row. In death row, the custom is that you're given your last meal, whatever you want. So the warden came over to the prisoner who was in death row, and he asked him, as this is the custom of our institution, This is your last meal. What can I give you? He says, you know what? I'd like some watermelon. He says, watermelon? It's not in season. I'll wait. Yeah. So sometimes the good times will come. Sometimes you just have to wait. Rav Yosef declined the position. His colleague lived for 22 years in that position. And finally, when his colleague died, and there's absolutely no one to take that position of that stature, he took that position. He lived for 2.5 years and he died. You know, just remind, speaking about palm reading, is a funny thing. And again, there's no proof from anecdotes, but it's a cute story. When I gave a similar class about palm reading and things are faded, and someone in the audience raised his hands and said, you know, if someone read my palm and told me that I would have 3 children and I would live for 70 years. Well, I do have 3 children. And he was around 68 at the time. He was a little worried. And he asked me, you know, what's up? So I told him, listen, I can't. You know, but Lamai said, one thing you see from the Talmud, you know, that like Rabbi Akiva's daughter, charity, prayer, charity, it has an effect. He's still alive again. In conclusion, so I just want to go over now. I want to go over the fortune, so hopefully you go home, you'll remember it. And I'm going to conclude with just a few stories. One is the F of fortune is fate. Because there is something before a person, but in the time of the embryo, there's the path of a life is determined. O ordained, besides what's fated at birth, there's constant judgment, even afterwards. Even when you stub your finger, it's bashert. But you should realize it's all part of God's plan. That's Rabbi Akiva. Everything that God does is for the best, even though we don't understand it and it looks terrible. R is recklessness. Don't tempt fate. Because if you're in a difficult situation, you may be worthy, but it wasn't bashert for you to die or to be injured, but God is not necessarily going to make a miracle here. It reminds me of the cute joke. I heard this from a physician. He was telling me that about a man who lived a full life, but did everything just so. And the language in Hebrew is b'di'evad. B'di'evad means after the fact. He did, you did it, okay, it's done. But it wasn't really done the preferable way. But yeah, that's the way he lived life. Everything he did like that. When he died, he went through the divine truth. He went before the, according to the joke, he went to the divine tribunal. And they were looking at his record, and it wasn't so great. But they figured, you know what? He's here already. B'di'evad, let him stay. So he was walking around, according to the joke, he's walking around heaven, looking around. It's interesting. And he found himself by a landing. You know? And by the landing, there's a little landing. He could, you know, there's a little fence. They could look over the fence. And he sees a big fire down there. Which, according to the joke, that's hell. He's very interested. It looks interesting. He's looking and looking. He's trying to get a better look and leans over this parapet, this landing. And he falls, loses his footing and falls, and he screams, help, help, get me out of here. I don't belong here. He makes such a ruckus that the divine tribunal run to this balcony, this landing. They take a look at him, and one looks at the other and says, he's right. He doesn't belong there. Yeah. B'di'evad, like he's there already, let him stay. So the idea of don't be reckless, be prudent. The T is teshuva. You could change at least much of it by changing yourself. And we discussed the idea of changing yourself, the idea of prayer. which really is not just a wish list or you're nagging, not nudging, but really you're making a connection with God. So we think of tzedakah, and really tzedakah is also, you know, there's two parts of giving charity. One is, of course, being kind. You can be kind even without just saying a kind word. The Talmud describes, says that there are, quotes a verse, and he says that there are six blessings, which it enumerates from a certain verse, that are given to one who gives charity. But there are 11 blessings to one who speaks nicely, who lifts up the spirits of the person in need. Kindness doesn't have to be done through money. You become a godly person by being a kind person. But charity itself is a statement. The statement is, the money that I have is not mine. I'm a caretaker. And basically, it's a view of how you look life. We're all, in one way or another, each one of us has their challenges, and each one of us has their brachas, their blessings. But everything that we're given, we're just caretakers. God gives us, says, I want you to do the good, the right thing with that. So when a person gives of his money, and it's very often it's hard-earned money, it came with difficulty very often, but you use that as an act of kindness, as an act to improve the world. It's a statement that, you know, everything that I have really is not mine. It's really God's. I'm a partner with God. You look at life, like it's a whole different world. You have to excuse me, but it reminds me of a great joke. I hope you excuse me, I'm running late, but it reminds me of a great joke. You know, it's so bad. You know, my wife always tells me, and I speak too long. Yeah, it hit home. This is not really true, but it hit home the day that I was giving a speech, and someone walked out in the middle, and I asked him, "Where are you going?" "So I'm going to get a haircut." I said, "Why did you take a haircut before you came? Before I heard you, I didn't need a haircut." But there's a great story about five Jewish tailors. And they came from the old country, each one a different section of the city. And they made up that once a year they would come together in one of the parks of the city and would come together, speak of old times. It was a great thing. Year after year they would come, each one in their Chevy. One year, one of them comes. And comes in a limousine with a chauffeur. He comes out, looks like a different man. And they see, he says, this is success is written all over him. And the others asked him, you know, what happened? He says, you know, I was just like you. I was struggling. And I decided, you know what? I need to bring God as a partner in my business. Whatever I'm going to make, God is my partner. And as soon as I made that commitment, my whole life changed. I got so busy that I had to hire other tailors. And it came to the thing that I bought wholesale, I sold things off the rack. I had to expand my business, that I had to break through the three adjacent stores. And I got so big, it came one after the other. It says that I opened up various stores within the city, and soon I have stores all across the country. He says, really? What's the name of your store? Well, you know what? I wanted to pick a name that shows really myself, the business, and my partner. And I called it Lord and Taylor. Yeah. I just want to end off. We spoke about mazel. We spoke about bad mazel. But you know what? Sometimes you look at life, and it may not be as bad as you think. Reminded of a story that I heard about someone who came to a rabbi, was complaining. This is bad, and that's bad. The rabbi really couldn't take it anymore, took his pencil, and behind him was a white wall. Couldn't do it on these walls. Behind him was a white wall. He took the pencil and he put three dots on the wall. And he asked the man, "What do you see?" I see three dots. "But there's a whole white wall. You can't see the wall. All you can see is the dots." "Yeah, our lives, there are a lot of dots in our lives. But there's a lot of white. You know, sometimes if you have mazel, it may be if you count your blessings." Sometimes I tell people, you know, it'd be good to make a list of all the good things in your life. We tend to concentrate on the dots. And in conclusion, just share you this very cute joke, very cute story about this man who made his fortune, an immigrant, made his fortune in New York, retired to Florida, was standing on the curb one day, waiting for a bus or to the cross. A bus comes, barely misses him, you know, as it's coming. He falls back, loses his footing, and falls back on his head, becomes temporarily unconscious. The bystanders there immediately called the EMS, emergency service. One of them took a jacket off of his put it on him that the man should go into shock. Before EMS came, the man came to. And the person who was helping him said, "Sir, are you comfortable?" And he looked down. Imagine the scene. "Are you comfortable?" He says, "Thanks God, I make a nice living." You know, if we look at it, like we went through this about changing it, about having patience. But, you know, in the final analysis, it may not be so bad after all. So you have a good night. Okay, be well.